Coming up, combat veterans suffering from what's been called moral wounding.
We don't really have a consciousness of our own spirit until it's wounded, and then it needs help.
And a controversial question: should a faith-based group that gets government money be allowed to hire on the basis of religion?
A faith-based organization is only faith-based if it can hire people of the particular faith that it espouses.
That's dead wrong, and it should be stopped.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're yourretirementcompany.com. Also by the Henry Luce Foundation and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Welcome, I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us. New figures released this week by the government confirm that the Gulf Coast oil spill is the worst pollution disaster in U.S. history. Religious communities continue to respond. Churches in Louisiana are holding special services to pray for help in the recovery, and local faith groups are providing aid for those whose livelihoods are in jeopardy. Catholic Charities in New Orleans said nearly 5,000 people have sought emergency food or counseling. On Capitol Hill, evangelicals held a rally for the environment at an event billed as a National Day of Prayer for Creation Care. Religious leaders said better stewardship of the earth is a moral imperative.
Well, I think the Gulf Spill really just points out to how addicted we are to fossil fuels. You know, we continue to scrape in every ounce of fossil fuel energy we can get out of the earth. And I think it's really a time for us to wake up and call and to look for renewables, ways that we can be a lot better of God's stewards of the earth.
This Memorial Day weekend, the nation remembers all those who've lost their lives at war. We have a report today on those coming back from war with crippling fear and anger, so-called post-traumatic stress disorder. And now some combat veterans are suffering the guilt and shame associated with what's called moral wounding. Lucky Severson reports.
Happy days in Roswell, New Mexico, as soldiers in a National Guard engineer company deployed in Afghanistan come marching home. For some, unless they get called back, the war is over. For others, it's only begun.
I was a rifleman. And
in an infantry unit.
In an infantry line unit.
Marines.
Correct. Marine Corps Infantry.
Michael Abatella joined the Marines September 12, 2001, the day after the terrorist attack on the Twin Trade Towers. Like tens of thousands of American soldiers coming home, he has struggled with the warning signs of post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD. Symptoms like nightmares, insomnia, hypervigilance, and guilt. And for him, something even deeper, a wounding of the soul.
Something is changed. You know, you feel down to your spirit, you know, that you're different now. You know, we don't really have a consciousness of our own spirit until it's wounded. And then it needs help.
With the increase in crime and suicide among veterans of Iraq and Afghanistan, the notion that war can actually damage or warp the soul has been gaining traction among experts in the field. Nancy Sherman, a professor at Georgetown University, has studied and written extensively about the hearts, minds, and souls of soldiers.
I like to talk about the moral emotions of war, and they include wounds, but they're the hard, bad feelings that may erode at your character. That's the really deep ones.
And I hope that you will work for reconciliation.
The kind of emotional wounds Lieutenant Colonel Eric Olson witnessed as a chaplain in Iraq.
It's a hard place where you're asked to do some very difficult things. And once you've crossed those lines, it's hard to navigate back. It is a soul wound. It's definitely a soul wound.
Michael Abatello is still suffering from the guilt that his unit wasn't there to protect an Afghan father who had provided intelligence on the enemy to the Marines.
He had trusted us to some degree that we would be there to support him and his family if he was going to be taking chances to help us. And we betrayed his trust to, not even to a certain degree. I mean, we weren't there for him. So yeah, I have guilt.
What happened to him?
Him and his family were gunned down in front of their house. His beard was cut off, and he was stripped and laid on top of his family.
You knew the kids too, didn't you?
Yeah.
The kids, the whole family.
Yeah.
A recent survey by the RAND Corporation found that over 300,000 veterans are suffering from some form of PTSD, which has put enormous pressure on veterans' hospitals like this one in Los Angeles, which also houses New Directions, a residential treatment program for veterans. Clinic Director Monica Martocci says no one knows the number of PTSD victims for certain because many veterans refuse to acknowledge it.
It doesn't bode well for their career if they're in any way seen as mentally unstable.
Those who have studied the issue say moral wounding is especially prevalent among recent vets because so many have served more than one tour of duty. Ed Tick operates a sanctuary called Soldier's Heart for stricken veterans and says they aren't the only ones suffering.
20% of active duty troops and as much as 40% of Guards and National Guardsmen and reservists are coming back with PTSD. These are astronomical numbers, and we could go through substance abuse and divorce and child abuse and homicide and imprisoned populations. So they are really hurting.
The Justice Department estimates that nearly a quarter of a million veterans of wars dating back to Vietnam are serving time behind bars. The New York Times found 121 cases in which Iraq and Afghan veterans committed murder after their return from war. Only a few had been screened for mental health problems, and unlike many civilian criminals, the overwhelming majority had no prior criminal record. Dr. Jonathan Shea, a neuroscientist who works with the Veterans Administration, ridicules the age-old theory that good breeding and good character will keep you morally strong even in the face of war.
Well, that idea has a great pedigree, and I'm afraid it's complete crap. It is simply wrong. Moral injury causes good character to become deformed.
It alters it. It alters who you are.
It makes you bitter. It makes you cynical. It makes you filled with hatred.
Michael Abatello had never been in trouble before, but served prison time after his wife convinced him to sell his personal unregistered guns to someone who turned out to be a government informer.
You get so used to having a rifle. You know, I used to get these fears, like I had forgotten my rifle somewhere. And to even imagine life without a rifle is scary.
Monica Martocci says Michael Abatello's attachment to guns is not uncommon.
That's what they were trained to do, and what they learned, especially in combat, is that the world is not a safe place, and they are taught to protect themselves and others. So, I mean, they think everyone else is crazy for not having a weapon with them at all times.
The rate of suicide among vets of the current wars has also been on the rise. A federal study in 2005 found that veterans were twice as likely to commit suicide as those who hadn't served in the military. And PTSD is considered a significant reason why almost 25% of America's homeless are veterans of all wars, even though they make up only 8% of the population.
We thank you for the food that's been provided for us.
The largest number of homeless vets reside in downtown Los Angeles, and many have found help at the venerable Union Rescue Mission. Anthony Ortega now works at Union Mission. He was injured by shrapnel while his National Guard unit was in Afghanistan. He found this place after living on the streets.
And then doing some of the things we have to do as far as serving our country, goes against what's in the Bible. But it's either my life or theirs. Coming back, having to deal with that was very difficult.
My problems came.
Billy Zinnerman was a sergeant major in the Marines. He says the first Gulf War, where he served on reconnaissance patrols, changed him spiritually.
And because you see no spirituality in war. Combat does not, for lack of a better word, expose you to the opportunity to serve the Lord.
After he lost his faith, he lost his wife and his home, and now he's trying to help other veterans at the Los Angeles Mission.
I don't know if you've ever been in a position to say to yourself, if you have believed in God and you think God has abandoned you, that's what you feel in combat. Because you feel there can be no God with this type of carnage going on.
Everyone we spoke with agrees that an important factor in the turbulent return of some vets is that much of the country has not shared the pain of the two wars they have been fighting.
You know, there's lip service to the service and to saluting the service. But does the public really understand in a deep way, empathically, what the moral burdens of war are? I don't think so.
The good news is the Department of Defense has instituted a reintegration plan for returning vets called the Yellow Ribbon Program. Chaplain Eric Olson officiated at this one.
We try to see them as soon as they come home, and in 30 days and 60 days, and we bring them together and sort of tell them what they're going to go through and help them just to navigate that.
And more churches are joining in, like the Unitarian Church here in Albany, New York, which recently sponsored its first Healing Circle ceremony for veterans like Michael Abatello.
I've lost more friends to suicides than I did in combat.
For too many veterans, coming home doesn't end with kisses and hugs. Now there's an increasing awareness, and some say an urgent need for America and Americans to step up and share the pain of our returning veterans and help them reclaim their lives. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Lucky Severson reporting.
According to the Pentagon, last year, for the first time, more military personnel were hospitalized for mental disorders than for injuries and battle wounds. In other news, the Obama administration has sided with the Vatican in an Oregon lawsuit over whether the Holy See can be sued for its handling of clergy sexual abuse. In a brief submitted to the U.S. Supreme Court, the Department of Justice argues that the case does not meet the standards by which a foreign nation can be sued in U.S. court. The U.S. recognizes Vatican City as a sovereign state. President Obama has a special White House office to build relationships with the faith communities. He has said religious groups can help solve some of America's biggest problems. But the administration is coming under increasing pressure over a controversial question. If faith-based groups take government money, should they be allowed to hire on the basis of religion? Kim Lawton has our report.
It's graduation time at the Helping Up Mission, a non-denominational Christian ministry for poor and homeless men in Baltimore. On this day, several men are being recognized for reaching new stages of success in their recovery from drug and alcohol addiction. Helping Up believes that spirituality plays a key role in the recovery process, and it wants those who work there to reflect its values. The ministry relies largely on private donations, but it has received some public funding as well. And that raises a difficult question. If the mission takes government money, should it still be allowed to only hire people who share its religious beliefs?
A faith-based organization is only faith-based if it can hire people of the particular faith that it espouses. So if, for instance, we were not able to discriminate in our hiring practices based on our faith and religion, that would change us.
I don't think that there's any moral or ethical or constitutional justification for a religious group taking government funds, tax dollars, and then saying, we're only going to hire the people we want. We're going to have a religious litmus test for hiring. That's dead wrong, and it should be stopped.
For decades, religious groups have been partnering with the government to provide a host of social services in the U.S. and around the world. Those partnerships attracted new visibility and new controversy after President George W. Bush created his faith-based initiative.
People who don't have hope can find hope.
In his words, to level the playing field so that more religious groups could compete for government grants. A series of laws, regulations, and court decisions have tried to ensure that the faith-based partnerships don't violate the Constitution.
We're going to have grace so we can...
For example, tax dollars may not be used to fund proselytizing. But the issue of religious hiring remains one of the most contentious questions. The Civil Rights Act of 1964 and its regulations banned discrimination in hiring, but granted faith groups an exemption, allowing them to hire on the basis of religion. But Barry Lynn, executive director of Americans United for Separation of Church and State, says federal funding should change the calculus.
Whenever government money enters the picture, then the civil rights rubric of our country is you don't get to discriminate anymore. If you're engaged in federal work with federal money, you really have to play by the same rules as everyone else. You don't get to be a bigot. You don't get to discriminate. You don't get to select people for a job or fire people from a job because of their religious beliefs or orientation.
Stanley Carlson Teese heads the Institutional Religious Freedom Alliance, which helps faith-based groups protect their identity and practices. He says the law allows religious groups to create an organizational philosophy, as other federally funded entities do.
I think the faith groups see it as, like a Democratic senator hires Democrats for his or her office, and environmental groups hire environmentally sensitive people and so on. And they say, hey, we're a faith group. It's faith that motivates us, defines us. So we're looking for people who share that faith.
Carlson T. sees this as an issue that pits an individual's rights against institutional rights. He says for faith groups, it's not discrimination in the traditional sense.
It's not like they think of this as you grow up on the wrong side of the tracks, we're going to keep you out. No, it's more, do you share the things that motivate us? Do you have the same set of values? Do you have the same set of behaviors?
On the presidential campaign trail in July 2008, candidate Barack Obama visited a Christian youth program in Zanesville, Ohio, and promised that his administration would continue partnerships between faith-based groups and the government. But he said there would be a few caveats.
First, if you get a federal grant, you can't use that grant money to proselytize to the people you help, and you can't discriminate against them or against the people you hire on the basis of their religion.
When President Obama set up his White House Office of Faith-Based and Neighborhood Partnerships, many civil rights groups expected to see all religious hiring preferences banned in federally funded programs. That hasn't happened. Instead, Joshua Dubois, head of Obama's faith office, has outlined a different course.
With regard to the issue of co-religionist hiring discrimination, it's a difficult topic and one that where there are very clear and strong opinions on both sides. The president has decided to take a case-by-case approach, and as difficult legal issues arise, he wants me to work with the White House counsel, with the attorney general, to explore those issues and give him a recommendation.
A case-by-case basis is like saying, well, maybe Rosa Parks, maybe in the front of the bus, other African-American women, they get into the back of the bus. There is no way to deal with fundamental civil rights issues on a case-by-case basis.
Both Carlson Teese and Lynn were on a task force about government partnerships for Obama's Faith Advisory Council. But the hiring question wasn't allowed to even be part of the discussion. It's an issue of deep concern for many faith-based charities, including Helping Up in Baltimore. The Residential Addiction Recovery Program has about 400 homeless addicts who live here for at least a year. They go through a 12-step program and receive counseling, medical help, job training, and Bible study.
Many of our men here have tried other programs, and they've come to us because they particularly like the faith-based ingredient that we have here. It offers them the kind of hope that they need in order to get beyond
all the failures that they've had in the past.
That was a case for Michael Anthony Gross, who came here after 3 decades of cocaine and heroin addiction.
When I was in detox, I talked to a gentleman and he recommended the Helping Up Mission. And he spoke about the spiritual basis that, you know, the program is run on. And I come to know that after all these years, that's what I was missing.
The mission's internal surveys have found that 2 years out, almost 80% of the men who complete the program are still drug-free and employed. The program accepts men from all religious backgrounds, and leaders say religion isn't imposed on anyone. The men may opt out of chapel or Bible study, but if they do, they must attend another 12-step style meeting. Tom Bond is Helping Up's program director, who in 2002 came here himself as a homeless addict.
The whole faith and recovery, both are highly unique. What we do is we just try to create kind of a platform and a vehicle for these guys to succeed and make things available to them and let them figure things out for themselves, not force it on them.
Gaiman says the mission has been careful not to use any public money for the explicitly religious parts of the program. But he says hiring people who share the mission's faith is central to maintaining its identity. If the government makes non-discrimination a condition, they wouldn't be able to accept public funding. And he says that would give other groups an unfair advantage.
It really gives secular organizations a real power edge because they're fully funded. They can build their buildings, they can develop their programs, and the faith-based organizations are left to have to raise their own money, which is becoming increasingly difficult.
Indeed, says Carlson Teese, if the administration changed the long-standing policy, many charities from across the religious spectrum may be forced to end their partnerships with the government.
It's not that we just say, well, fine, if you want to walk away, because this implicates, you know, billions of dollars and big volume of services.
One organization that might be affected is World Vision, the largest U.S.-based relief and development group. World Vision has been taking federal funds since 1983 and last year received more than $300 million in cash and goods from the government. The Christian group wants to maintain the right to consider religion in its hiring. World Vision's chief legal officer told me his organization has never discriminated among its recipients or engaged in illegal hiring practices. But he said if the policy changes and World Vision can no longer partner with the government, quote, the losers would be children in need around the world and American taxpayers.
Scientific studies certainly don't demonstrate that World Vision is the only group that can help the poor around the world. Nor does it suggest that the best charities at home are those that have a religious title affixed to their name.
With strong pressure from both sides, the Obama administration has been reluctant to clarify its position or make any changes. White House officials declined to comment for this story as well. But with several court cases moving in the pipelines, the issue isn't going away. I'm Kim Lawton in Washington.
The President and First Lady welcomed a diverse group of Jewish guests to the first ever White House reception for Jewish American Heritage Month. The highly anticipated guest list included politicians, artists, athletes, and religious leaders. Among those in attendance were pitcher Sandy Koufax, children's book author Judy Blume, and Olympic swimmer Dana Torres. In his remarks, President Obama praised the contributions of Jewish Americans and reaffirmed his commitment to Israel. On our calendar, May 29th, the anniversary of the ascension of Baha'u'llah, the founder of the Baha'i faith. The day is one of 9 holidays on which Baha'is suspend work and school. Finally, it only took about 500 years, but in Poland this week, a scientist whose work was once condemned by the Catholic Church received a proper burial. Nicholas Copernicus, the astronomer who asserted that the Earth revolves around the Sun, was originally buried in an unmarked grave. His body was recently unearthed, and forensic scientists were able to identify his remains using DNA from hairs found in a book he once owned. The burial ceremony took place in a cathedral where Copernicus once served as a church canon. That's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. We have much more on our website, including more about the moral wounds of war and more of our interviews on faith-based hiring. You can follow us on Facebook, comment on all of our stories, and share them. Audio and video podcasts are also available. Join us at pbs.org. As we leave you, for Memorial Day, the annual planting of flags at Arlington National Cemetery.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're yourretirementcompany.com. Also by the Henry Luce Foundation and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.